I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In. Today's guest, psychiatrist, professor, and researcher Randolph Nesse, is a co-founder of the field of evolutionary medicine. 25 years ago, his book, Why We Get Sick, which he co-authored with George C. Williams, went on to sell more than 100,000 copies and to be translated into 8 languages. He served for many years on the faculty of the University of Michigan, where he is a professor emeritus, and was also the founding director of the Center for Evolution and Medicine at Arizona State University, where he continues to be a research professor. His most recent book, Good Reasons for Bad Feelings, is the subject of today's interview. So Randy, welcome to Delving In.
Thank you, Stuart. So glad to have a chance to talk with you.
Okay, so first off, congratulations on your new book, on your long and distinguished career, and on your unflagging openness to thinking outside the box. You've seen some big changes in the field of psychiatry over the last many decades. Early in your career, psychiatrists were still learning psychoanalysis, and the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, had undergone its first revision, still emphasizing psychoanalytic concepts. By 1980, the DSM-3 had arrived, which replaced these concepts with clusters of behavioral descriptors. The explicit aim of this and subsequent revisions, we're now up to the DSM-5, was to improve the reliability of the diagnostic process, but at the cost of minimizing the importance of the patient's life situation. By the late 1980s, Prozac and its offspring had entered the market, and the shift to psychiatric medication management was in full swing, an emphasis in psychiatry that continues to dominate. The overriding assumption within psychiatry and communicated to the general public is that mental disorders are primarily brain diseases and that the genetic causes and definitive treatment of them are just around the corner. Now, I imagine that while you appreciate the contributions of these and other approaches, you felt that something was missing in our understanding of mental illness and of human suffering in general. So how did your own understanding of evolutionary psychiatry evolve?
What a good question. I wanted to call myself an eclectic psychiatrist as I was starting my faculty position at the University of Michigan, and it was soon very obvious that was not a proper specialty for a psychiatrist. And I didn't want to become a behaviorist or a psychoanalyst or a psychopharmacologist or a family therapist. I wanted to use everything we know to try to understand and help my patients. And so I was somewhat frustrated. My original research was looking at neuroendocrine responses to anxiety. We brought snakes into the room and measured how people's blood and changed and how their pulse changed and how their subjective experiences changed. And it was fascinating that I got very erratic responses. You would think that everybody's cortisol would have gone up or something. People were so individually different. And I think that experience really influenced me the whole way. It wasn't until I'd been on the faculty for about 8 years that I found my way to the Museum of Natural History and biologists who studied behavior full time. And they welcomed me. But the first thing they said is, oh, all psychiatrists study evolutionary biology in depth, right? And I said, no. In fact, I don't know anybody who has any interest in that. And they quickly explained that my whole wonderful education had only used one half of biology. I had only learned the half of biology that described how things worked and the mechanisms and what went wrong. I hadn't learned anything about why the brain was the way it was and the evolutionary forces that make animals and people do the things that they do. So they opened my eyes and I haven't looked back.
So you quote Einstein as saying, if at first the idea is not absurd, then there is no hope for it. But I have to say that your ideas don't seem all that absurd to me, so I hate to break the news.
You know, there's nothing radical. People say, oh, it's a radical idea, evolutionary psychiatry. Well, it's nothing radical about it. It's just using the basic science of evolutionary biology, which has been sitting there all the time and which is the accepted foundation for all studies of animal behavior, and trying to provide it as a foundation for understanding and treating mental disorders. However, hardly any psychiatrists or clinical psychologists get a proper education in biology and behavior. So this is going to take another few decades.
Yeah, it really sounds to me like it makes total sense. And when I read your book, it's, oh, yes, of course, there were definitely nuggets in there that I hadn't thought of before. But the overall approach, it seemed like a kind of a paradigm shift in a way, more than anything else.
Oh, you used a P word. I avoid using the P word because every time somebody talks about a paradigm shift, really, they're just a crank, usually. It really is a different Do we want to use the P word? I don't know. It's just using a basic science that has not been applied in this area. And there are good reasons why, I think. For most people, those who understand how evolution does work, they can understand very quickly how natural selection shapes things that work well. But what I've been doing with my entire career is trying to use evolutionary ideas to understand why some systems are vulnerable to failure, both in medicine and in psychiatry in particular. And that's a little hard for people to make that wrenching transition from how natural selection makes things work well to why the heck didn't it do a better job.
So this is a kind of a silly analogy. I moved here from Boston, and in Boston, the streets are really crazy looking. They're just very narrow and winding, and it's a terrible traffic.
I hate driving in Boston. I hate it.
Yeah, but you know, if you understand the evolution of the road system, there were cow paths, right? They were way before cars, and so you didn't have the reasons to make roads the way they are now.
You just helped me to make one of my metaphors. Thank you so much for this. One of the core principles of evolutionary medicine is called path dependence. And whenever I talk about it, I talk about our computer keyboards. They're QWERTY, so all the keys are not in the most efficient place. They're in places that slow us down in our typing, because originally typewriters had a problem if you push two keys next to each other and they got stuck. But you just pointed out that the cow paths led to path dependence for streets in Boston, making them curlicue and confusing and narrow and suboptimal. And lots of things in our bodies and our minds are suboptimal because natural selection can't start fresh. It's path dependent, and every change has to be built on something before. So we have a nerve that goes down from our neck all the way around the aorta and comes back up to our vocal cords. All kinds of things in the body just are not designed right, because natural selection can never start fresh.
So you use the word design, but I think as an evolutionary psychiatrist, you don't believe, I don't think, that everything is designed with a blueprint by God, let's say. And not that you're necessarily doubting the existence of God, but things evolve in a way that can be not inconsistent, but planned from start to finish. And so you have competing systems. And,
yeah. You've put your finger on a continuing controversy. I did a video interview with Richard Dawkins for a British public television station a long time ago, and he gave me quite a hard time for using the word design. He says, you don't want to use the word design because that's what the creationists say, and there's no design. And I said, you know what? Natural selection creates designs, the noun, but the process of design is limited to humans thinking about things. Natural selection shapes things mindlessly without any conscious plan, forethought, or direction. It just does it. But Richard Dawkins, in the last few months, has been openly saying, we should be using the word design. And Dan Dennett is a famous philosopher who says the same thing. And I'm right now, today, arguing with some co-authors of an article we're submitting to the Proceedings of the National Academy about whether I should use the word design or not. So natural selection creates designs, but it is not a designer. Designers are limited to engineers and people who think up things ahead of time.
So another way of saying that is that the design is not done to perfection. It's done kind of willy-nilly by an accretion process, and it happens over time and in response to specific environments that change over time.
The most common misunderstanding about evolution is that it has a direction or a purpose or a goal. And it's hard for people to grasp how this all works. The analogy I use is the penny jars that back in the days when most of us had coins in our pocket anyway. You'd come home at night and you'd take the coins from your pocket and you'd put them in the jar, and it would be a mixture of quarters, nickels, dimes, and pennies. And sometimes when you wanted some money, you'd take some out, but you would take it out selectively. That is the action of selection. And by the time 6 months or a year goes by, you've got a jar that's almost all pennies and hardly any nickels, dimes, and quarters. This is selection. And how do you explain that the jar has turned into all pennies? It's a process of selection. Likewise, you go to the grocery store on a Sunday evening, and guess what? Selection's been going on there too, and all the fresh lettuce is gone. You're left with a few wilted kinds of things. Or you go to the convenience store, the 7-Eleven or the like, and you ask, how come these things are on the shelves and they don't have other things on the shelves? And there's a very easy explanation for that. It's a process of selection. Whatever people buy, they will restock on those shelves. And whatever people don't buy, they will not restock. So if you ask the question, how can you explain what shows up on the 7-Eleven shelves? It's a process of selection. But none of these, of course, are natural selection. These are selections that people make that shape things like what's on the shelves in 7-Eleven. Natural selection, however, is just the same process of some individuals having more offspring than others. And as a result, over the generations, those individuals who tend to have more offspring, the whole population becomes more like them. It would be so wonderful if the whole system were designed to shape us to be healthy, happy, long-lived, and cooperative. But very sadly, it doesn't. It only shapes us to do whatever it is that keeps us alive and encourages reproduction.
And that's a very sad thing, because one would hope that evolution would have been nicer.
I think we should pause here for just a moment. So we should just pause and note, it is absolutely wonderful that people can live so long, so healthily, and that we can have good friends and love each other, and there's a lot of good people out there too. How is that possible? We just need to slow down and take satisfaction that this process of natural selection is not as simple. And some people say, oh, natural, it's all nature red and tooth and claw, and it's all nasty. It's mindless, and it just does. But what's the best way to maximize the number of offspring? You better have friends. And in order to have friends, you better be a decent person. And you better choose the best possible people for your friends. And in that process of choosing who you want to spend time with, you are creating selection forces, because that means that the people who are most appreciated as potential partners, friends, and group members, they get the other best potential partners and groups to pair with, giving all of those folks advantages. So this is an explanation for the origins of human goodness that's much different from simplistic ones about saying it's all an accident or it's a product of group selection or something. It's a very simple explanation. This is called social selection or partner choice. And it's so fascinating that perfectly self-interested choices of who we want to spend time with and who we want to have sex with, of course, but let's keep it simple, who we want to spend time with and cooperate with, those self-interested choices create strong selection forces for morality, guilt, and caring a lot what other people think about us.
Yeah, I really appreciated your discussion of that in the book as a kind of alternative way of looking at this, the selfish gene. And that people have had a hard time explaining altruism. And I thought your explanation was quite convincing, that it becomes an attractive trait. If you see someone as a good person, a generous person, a responsible person, that actually makes them more attractive. And if they're more attractive, they're more likely to have offspring. It seemed like a very perfectly good explanation to me. I'm wondering if Richard Dawkins agrees with that.
I've talked with Richard about it, and he basically says, yeah, that can contribute to it. I don't think he quite gets the depth of it, though. He's still fighting the battles against the group selectionists because they're wrong. The other idea, probably many of your listeners don't know about this controversy, but many people say, obviously, if you do something and you make a sacrifice to do something that benefits the group, even something much less dramatic than jumping on top of a grenade, which is the thing people all think about. But if you do something that benefits the group but harms you, that's going to benefit the group. And that's how those traits for altruism evolve. Except that doesn't work. I just gave a lecture here last week when I showed a Walt Disney film about lemmings jumping into the fjord. Do you know that story?
I know that it was a fake situation, that they were being chased by the filmmakers.
Oh, I was going to use that as a punchline. So the editors were quite certain that lemmings jumped into the fjord when food got scarce so that they wouldn't eat all the food so the species could survive. And these individuals were sacrificing themselves for the good of the group. But guess what? They couldn't find any lemmings doing that. They had to pay somebody to trap the lemmings and sweep them into the fjord off camera, making a great example of manufacturing evidence to support your theory, even when the theory is false.
Yeah, I've also heard that female praying mantises only bite the heads off of their male mates if you starve them for a while first.
Really? I'll have to look that one up. But I had always thought they had a good meal out of it.
Let's shift now a little bit before we come back to the kind of the main topic here. And that's in the aftermath of the mapping of the human genome completed in 2003, massive-sized genetic studies have thus far failed to find even a single gene that underpins any psychiatric disorder to any significant degree. And you talk about this in your book. And those that are found turn out to be false alarms, or at best explain only 1% or less of the variants. and there are still no lab tests or scans for detecting and diagnosing mental illness. What are the implications of these failures for the continued dominance of biological psychiatry? And I guess what a biological psychiatry mean as it's currently practiced.
Neuroscience kind of things is what you're talking about. And I should say, I'm the first to hope that all of those efforts will still succeed. All of us either have relatives or friends or patients who have very serious disorders, some of which I think are clearly caused by brain abnormalities, which are caused by genes, schizophrenia, obsessive compulsive disorder, autism. I hope we will find specific genes and specific brain abnormalities, but it is so disturbing and important to recognize that so far we have not. Everybody thought we would back, you know, when we first sequenced the genome, but that hasn't worked out. So now the question is, why were we thinking wrong? And we were thinking that each gene had specific effects, just like a particular gene causes muscular dystrophy, or a particular gene causes multiple or causes cystic fibrosis. But most traits are caused by thousands of genes, which don't even increase the risk, as you just said, by 1%. We need to think about things differently. And an evolutionary view gives you an idea about how we should go about thinking about those things differently. I'm doing work now with a biochemist at Duke named Fred Neithaut, who has a wonderful mathematical model for things like what's called single carbon metabolism, another model for dopamine metabolism. And the general principle that we're pursuing is that the idea that specific genes connect to specific traits in simple ways is just plain wrong. Natural selection shapes things like our behaviors by tiny genetic changes, either increasing or decreasing reproductive success. And every time one of those genes gets a little advantage, it becomes more and more common each generation. However, it almost certainly screws up three or four other things in the brain. And this, I call this a wrenching transition, because something that makes one thing better makes four other things worse, and that creates new selection to make those other problems better. And I've been thrilled just in recent months to see that there actually is new genetic data to test these kinds of ideas. And people have been saying for decades that somehow or another, the change to language and the social niche and cognition and thinking and the like was very stressful for humans and somehow is responsible for the prevalence of disorders like schizophrenia. But that's just been talk. There's been no way to test it. And Liu is in a paper just 3 years ago and another paper published last year, found a way to test it. They asked the question, if something happened maybe 100,000 years ago where different skills were needed, creating strong selection for talking and thinking and social skills, if something really changed in our environment, so that was what influenced reproductive success, maybe it screwed up a lot of other things and increased the risk of things like schizophrenia. If that's the case, they said, there should be a tendency for some of these older genes to increase the risk of schizophrenia. And then that should have created new selection for compensatory genes that compensate for those and reduce the risk. So we should see the newer genes that have just shown up in the last 100,000 years being protective, and the older genes causing more problems. And that's exactly what they found. I think it's so thrilling that this genetic data can show things. But now we're going to go back to your very important point at the beginning. How much does all this explain of the proportion of who gets schizophrenia? A few percent. Yes, the majority of variation in who gets schizophrenia is accounted for by genetic differences, not by childhood, it's not by what they eat, not by anything else. It's caused by genetic differences. But that does not mean that there are just a few specific genes that are going to account for it. And sadly, it also does not necessarily mean that there's a specific kind of problem in the brain that we can find with a brain scan. I wish we could. It's been so disappointing that we haven't. If we could find specific genes or brain loci, that would give us a running start at finding better ways of preventing and treating these terrible problems. But we haven't so far. And many of us in evolutionary psychiatry are saying we need to back up and try to think about why are some of these systems intrinsically vulnerable to failure? And that's a very deep, hard question.
So just a moment ago, you talked about how schizophrenia and other major mental illnesses are an expression of something going wrong in the brain, something abnormal. And I think that's an assumption that has yet to be proven. Certainly there's a vulnerability, but we don't really know of any kind of brain abnormality that's of any permanent sort in any case. Certainly the brain is functioning abnormally, but that's different than saying there's a brain abnormality.
The metaphor that resonates for most people has to do with our computers. When our computers fail, does that mean the mechanism and the transistors aren't working? Or is it that the software has somehow gotten tangled up so that the information processing is not working, even though the hardware is intact? And that's probably an artificial metaphor because the software and hardware of the brain are not separate the way computer software and hardware are. But I think it makes it useful for us to recognize that many of these more severe mental problems really are failures of control systems and information processing. That sounds too intellectualized and fancy, but that's what they are, is failures of computer processing for information. Obsessive compulsive disorder is especially interesting. People who are convinced that if they don't keep washing their hands, they're going to have germs on them that are going to kill their children. And so sometimes they wash until their hands are raw and even down to the bone. It's so tragic. I've treated hundreds of people with obsessive compulsive disorder. And you have to ask, how come the off signal doesn't work? And I think this is an area where we kept looking for specific genes or brain loci, but I think a different approach to obsessive compulsive disorder is to try to ask, how does a normal system know when to stop doing these protective behaviors? And why doesn't that control system work properly in people with obsessive compulsive disorder?
You know, let's talk about your central question in the book is why do mental disorders exist at all? And I think you invoke the smoke detector principle as one of the possible reasons. So let's hear about that.
There are two different kinds of mental disorders that are very different from each other. The ones that are most common are bad feelings, depression, anxiety mainly, but also anger and other kinds of things. And you really have to wonder who the heck designed this thing because so many people are bothered so much. And it's just, they're gigantic multi-billion dollar industries to help people get calm or experience happiness or get out of depression or just be mellow with other people. And I find it just so tragic that so many people are suffering this way. And I have asked myself over and again, why the heck was it designed that way? I used the word design again, didn't I? Why did natural selection make it that way? And now you brought up the smoke detector principle, and that's one of the answers. But first, we just have to pause and note that negative feelings are there for a reason. We wouldn't have any capacity for anxiety unless it was useful. And now we need to think about, what about people who don't have any anxiety? And there aren't very many of them because people who don't have any anxiety basically die young and they don't have very many offspring. So most of us have not just some anxiety, but more than we think we need. So now let's try to answer that question. Why is anxiety so prevalent in most people and so often excessive? I had been working at the University of Michigan Anxiety Disorders Clinic, one of the first in the country, for about 10 years when I finally realized, why is this so common? It's in me. It's in everybody. Why wasn't this thing shaped differently by natural selection so that we aren't so bothered? And I started thinking in mathematical terms about it and started asking myself, how many calories does it take to have a panic attack? And that takes maybe 100 calories. And what happens if you don't have a panic attack? If there's nothing bad, nothing. But if you're having panic attacks that help you escape from a lion who's going to eat you, then having a panic attack is going to save you 100,000 calories. And then I started looking into the mathematics. It's called signal detection theory. And you can calculate how loud a noise behind a rock is necessary before it's best to run away. And if the ratio of the cost of a panic attack to the cost of being eaten by a lion is 1,000 to 1, that means that anytime the noise behind the rock is greater than a proportion of 1 in 1,000 chance that there is a lion there, you should run. Because even though 999 times out of 1,000 it'll be a false alarm, that one time gives you a net advantage. And this is, we don't need to wear our seatbelts every time we drive our car, because hardly ever do we get in an accident. But we wear them because the cost of wearing a seatbelt is very small. And the cost of not wearing a seatbelt when you have an accident is gigantic. And we call this the smoke detector principle, because we all put up with smoke detectors that go off when we make toast, because we know we want to be warned early about any serious fire.
So you might say that anxiety and the capacity to feel anxiety is the mental equivalent of physical pain, that in both cases, the purpose, if I can be excused to use the word purpose, is to avoid danger and harm.
Well, I was inspired actually to think about many of these lines of thinking about emotions by one of my grade school classmates. He wasn't a classmate, he was in a different class, and he didn't experience pain. And let me tell you, none of us messed with this kid, because if you started a fight with him, he didn't care because he didn't experience pain. But behind his back, we all made fun of him, because we knew that every day when he went home, his mother had to strip him naked and look at every single inch to see where he might have injured himself without knowing it. And what I didn't know then but learned in medical school is these cases are very rare but very tragic. Because the kind of damage that people who experience no pain have usually results in them dying by their 30s or their 40s, and certainly not being able to walk very well in the meanwhile. So pain means there's something wrong, but it's a useful response. And if you don't have any pain, you are in deep trouble, just like if you don't have any anxiety. There's a disorder that is not treated very much. It's called hypophobia. Hypophobia just means you don't have enough anxiety. And nobody comes to our anxiety clinic saying, "I don't have enough anxiety, Dr. Nessie. Could you please help me?" Haven't seen that happen. But it's a real condition. There are people who end up in the emergency room or worse, the morgue. Actually, there was one guy who came to me there was a guy who raced motorcycles who wanted my advice. And he said that he was a professional motorcycle racer with big endorsements from cigarette companies and others. And he said, "Listen, I got this problem. The night before a race, I start vomiting and I can't sleep." And I said, "Geez, how long has this been going on?" He says, last couple of years." I said, "When did it start? What happened?" And he said, "Nothing. It's just, you got to help me. Give me a pill for it." And I said, "No, let's talk about when it really started." And he said, "There was my buddy, and he was in a race, and he got paralyzed." And I said, "Oh, gosh." And he said, "Yeah, but that's not going to happen to me." I said, and he said, "Anything else happening?" "Yeah, there was another buddy who was in a crash, and he broke his leg, and he's still not walking." I said, "Oh, geez. And for now, for you, you're having terrible anxiety that is making you almost not be able to race, right?" He said, "Absolutely. Can you give me a drug that'll stop my anxiety?" And I said, "You know what? We have to have a long talk about this, because your anxiety is trying to save your life. And I don't want to give you a drug that's going to block a useful response that might be saving your life."
So what's so complicated about anxiety versus physical pain is that threats can be very subtle and very symbolic and very social. And it's really hard to wrap your mind around it compared to the example of anxiety that you gave is really close to physical pain, because it's fear of actually being injured. But there's all kinds of psychological injury that's probably the cause of even more anxiety and more cases of anxiety.
So let's connect this with the beginning of our conversation, Stuart. It was social anxiety is something we all have. Yeah, only 5 or 10% of people have a diagnosable disorder. But how many of us don't feel anxious when we stand up in a room to say something? Actually, the people who don't feel anxious are the ones that you probably don't want to hang out with too much, because that tendency for being sensitive and caring what other people think about us is very deep, for those good reasons we talked about before, that social selection and partner choice means that we all are constantly aware about what other people think about us. And this helped me a lot in my clinical practice, treating many patients with social anxiety. They'd all come in saying, "I'm a failed person. What's wrong with me? I know I'm no good. I've got a disease." And I said, "Let's pause a second. There's something worse that you could experience, and that is not caring what other people think about you." And you could almost see the light bulb going off with many of these patients. They say, "Oh my gosh, there's something useful about this." For them, it was overshooting hugely. The recognition that there's something useful about these kinds of feelings is just so transforming for many patients.
So in your practice, you're very aware of vulnerabilities, their origins and evolution, but also you pay really strong attention to a person's circumstances, social and otherwise, as being a huge factor in diagnosis and treatment, And this is one way in which your career spans the time before the heyday of psychopharmacology, that you really do care about what life circumstances a patient is facing.
And that's what makes psychiatry and clinical psychology so interesting and rich and so challenging. I found literally every patient I saw took deep thinking and empathy and trying to talk with them in special ways to understand what's going on with this individual's life. And if you just make a DSM diagnosis by using a checklist and prescribe a drug, that's not only boring, you don't need an education to do that. It's just stupid. Plus, it's not good treatment. It's not good treatment because these feelings in many people do have meaning. And recognizing that meaning and being able to talk about what's going on in a person's life, I think, is fundamental. A lot of times when you do get into the details, you learn that, in fact, for this particular person, their anxiety has nothing to do with what's going on in their life. They were born with it, and their mother has it, and their sister has it, and it's just an unfortunate missetting of the threshold for expressing anxiety. For other people, once you get into it, it's learning and simple conditioning. For other people, it's, as you were mentioning before, symbolic things and wishes to do things that might get them in trouble that they're only partly aware of. So I think the whole area of psychiatry and clinical psychology is so rich and challenging to do it right. And you are right. I'm an opponent of this attempt to oversimplify everything and just make a crude diagnosis and prescribe a crude treatment. I don't think that's the best way of helping people.
And yet, I think you're also quite aware that there's a real shortage of mental health providers, psychiatrists in particular. And so you have some really interesting ideas in the book about how a psychiatrist with very limited time with each patient can get to the core problem. They won't necessarily have the time to actually help do the therapy, but at least they can help identify it. And one example was with depression. You have a question: is there something very important that you are trying to do that you can't succeed at and can't give up? I love that question. That really gets to the core of things.
Let's talk about that one. That's the question my residents that I've trained tell me is the most useful thing I've ever taught them. But it comes from some deeper theory. You have to ask the question for depression about, is there any situation in which lack of motivation, feeling pessimistic and down on yourself is useful? And the answer is, yeah, if there weren't such situations, there wouldn't be this capacity. And I try to distinguish between what I call low mood, which is everyday, mild, regular, bad feelings that are aroused by situations. And I distinguish that from depression because most people these days think of depression as an illness, and there's no point in arguing about that. So this capacity for low mood, why would it exist? And it exists because there are some situations in life where putting in a lot of energy and taking a lot of risks is going to pay off. And there are other situations in life where you're just going to be wasting your effort or getting yourself in trouble. And I sometimes talk about my ancestors on a small island off the coast of Norway for the last 1,000 years. I'm sure there were some who were really enthusiastic and positive. And in February, they decided, I'm hungry. I'm going to go get some food. I don't care if it's below zero and there's snow. I'm optimistic. I can find it. You know what happened to those folks, right? A lot of them never came home. And the folks who instead just were pessimistic and sitting there, they passed on more of their genes than those who were optimistic. Now, in modern times where we're not sitting on an island in the cold with no food around, none of these things seem quite as relevant. Most of us, most days, can do something useful because we're so privileged with the food and hot and cold running water and heat and ability to communicate with each other and even see each other on video. I mean, it's fabulous. But in the time of human evolution, there have been lots of times when enthusiasm and just doing things is not so smart. And even in situations where physical conditions weren't harsh, there were always conditions where conflicts between individuals left one individual winning and the other individual losing. And if that person who lost a status competition just kept on fighting, that is not going to be very good. That person is just going to get beat up more.
So in a way, you're saying that the person's body, so to speak, or their brain is forcing the person to give up when they should, or sometimes should in any case.
It's even more complicated than that, Stuart. A fellow named Eric Klinger back in the 70s wrote some profound articles about this. I don't see why everybody doesn't cite them. And he pointed out that when you're trying to do something and it's not working out very well, there's a whole sequence of emotional and cognitive responses that comes up. First of all, you just get frustrated and you kick the bucket and say, I'm going to try harder. And if that doesn't work, you pause for a while and say, you know what, I'm tired. I'm just not feeling like doing this anymore. And then if that doesn't work and you come back to the task, it doesn't work, you figure out a new strategy. I can't get into this school. Maybe I can get into that school. I can't get her to marry me. Maybe I can get somebody else. You know, you try a different strategy or a different goal. And if that doesn't work, the ordinary low mood tends to escalate into something more like depression. But the key here is that there are good circumstances. I call them propitious circumstances. That's where a small effort gives you a big reward. And there are also unpropitious circumstances in which no matter what you're going to do, it's not going to get you anything. It's going to waste effort and probably get you in trouble. So in those unpropitious circumstances, continuing to pursue an unreachable goal, the ordinary low mood escalates into depression if for some reason you can't stop pursuing the goal. And right here, a lot of people say sometimes for some radio interviews, Dr. Nessie, you think people should just give up their goals? No, that's not sensible at all. I'm glad we have a longer time than 10 minutes to talk here, Stuart, because these are subtle things. And you can't just talk to a patient and say, oh, you've been trying to get that woman to marry you for 3 years now and she won't. You should just quit. That shows all of the empathy of a brick. This is not what we need. There are always good reasons why people continue to pursue unreachable goals. And for some of them, you just have to shake your head and say, yeah, a mother trying to get her kid off drugs, a woman trying to get her husband to have sex, somebody trying to get a job, somebody trying to figure out how to help their spouse who is drinking 10 quarts of Coke every day and getting bigger and bigger. People find themselves in what I call social traps. And these social traps, it's very hard to get out of one of those things if you care about the person and the circumstance. Or they're trying to break into the National Football League or the Grand Ole Opry or get into graduate school and it's just not working because it's such a competitive business. Life is challenging for all of us, and gracefully figuring out when to hold them and when to fold them is a huge challenge we all face.
In your book, you talk about there's a kind of range of safety for diminishing these natural responses, whether it's a fever or nausea or things like that, that there's a kind of range in which you can suppress it most of the time, but there may be some situations where it would be really dangerous to do so.
Exactly. So, and this is why I spent 20 years not doing evolutionary psychiatry, but trying to understand why physical aspects of the body were vulnerable to disease. And so along with many others, I got into questions like, is it wise to reduce a fever? Why didn't natural selection offer better protection against cancer and heart disease? Why is it the birth canal is so narrow? Why do we have wisdom teeth? So the reason I get into evolutionary medicine is because it was quite clear early on that trying to understand abnormalities and normal responses having to do with our behavior and our minds, first I'd have to understand the rest of medicine. And that's growing very nicely now. And now I feel confident I can come back to mental disorders with new insights that are useful.
I'd like to talk about stress. And you point out in your book that stress is not just a number, that the details matter. And you wish that psychiatrists would actually ask for more details about a person's life and not just ask for a symptom checklist. And one thing that's really telling here is that the 2013 DSM-5, the latest version, removed Axis 4. And Axis 4 was stress. And you were supposed to enumerate the different stresses that the person was under. And what they found is that there wasn't enough inter-rater reliability on that score, and it was hard to give a number to it. So they just eliminated it entirely. And I think that's a problem.
Well, you said at the beginning, Stuart, they wanted to increase reliability. And much of my work has been on epidemiology. And you've got to be consistent in being able to say who has depression or who has schizophrenia or who has a disorder before you can do any proper epidemiology and mathematics about it. How do you do that? You have to make it a simple checklist. And the most egregious example of this has to do with bereavement. As you're probably aware, the older editions of the DSM had an exclusion. So within a certain number of weeks after losing a close loved one, you didn't get the diagnosis of depression. And Jerry Wakefield, I was on a Zoom with him the other day, a very wonderful author of Whatever Happened to Sadness is one of his wonderful books. But he pointed out to the people writing the revised version of the DSM, wait, if you have an exclusion for loss of a loved one, what about an exclusion for if you're in hospital and you've just become paralyzed? Or if your child has leukemia, why not an exclusion for that? And the powers that be thought about that and said, you know what? You're right. All of those things might influence the rates, but you can't measure them accurately, so we're going to get rid of all of them, including bereavement. So now, doesn't matter what's happened to you, your diagnosis of depression depends only on the number, duration, and severity of symptoms, which from a scientific standpoint, validity-wise, is complete nonsense. That's like someone having cough and somebody saying, you have cough disorder because you've coughed more than 3 times over 4 days and it's been deep and productive. No, you don't say that the cough itself is abnormal until you do an x-ray. And if the person has pneumonia or allergies or some other reason for the cough. And a lot of evolutionary psychiatry now is going towards trying to take a proper medical approach to emotional disorders. Because if you go to the doctor with a cough, the doctor tries to figure out what's causing it. If you go to the doctor with depression or anxiety, a lot of times you do not get a proper investigation of what might be causing it. And the reason, I think, is because a lot of times there isn't anything to be found. It's not always that there's something there. And it doesn't necessarily change how you're going to help the person. You're probably going to give medications and this similar kinds of therapy anyhow. But there are some times when it's absolutely essential to try to understand what's going on in a person's life. I propose that what we need to train people to do, and now we're coming back to practicality, is what's called a review of social systems. Doctors are taught in medical school to do what's called a review of systems. So almost all of your listeners will realize that sometimes their doctor is, they go in with a cough, and the doctor will say, how's your urinary system? How's your appetite? How's your vision? Are you having headaches? And you think to yourself, why is he asking all that? Or why is she asking all that? And the answer is because you really have to check out all the bodily systems to see if there might be a problem that's causing the cough. And likewise, with mental disorders, instead of a review of physical systems, we need to do a review of social systems. And we need to ask about each of the 6 main areas of life. And there's a nice acronym for that, SOCIAL, social resources, friends, and status, and positions, and group. Occupation, jobs, other things that people value about what you offer. C is children and family and kin. I is income and physical resources. A is your abilities and your appearance and your health. And finally, love and sex. And if you simply go through how things are going in each of those 6 areas with every patient, you discover things that you never would learn if you say, are you under stress? Most patients know better than to try to say, oh, yes, I'm under stress, because then it's going to get into a bunch of messy stuff that they don't want to talk about in 5 minutes. But if you say, how are things going with your kids? Are they healthy? Are they happy? Then you find out that one of the kids, the teachers are suggesting he be put on an ADHD medication the parents don't want to, and there's a lawsuit. And all of a sudden, you found your way to the central problem that this person is coping with in life. It also is, psychiatry is the richest, most interesting subspecialty in medicine, if it's done right.
That's a very key factor there. Yeah, I've long noticed that there seem to be only 2 diagnoses in the DSM that refer to etiology, and that's trauma and reactive attachment, which is also a kind of trauma. So when you have a trauma diagnosis, it implies that there was some event that happened that was traumatic. And all the other diagnoses are just symptoms.
Dan Stein is a psychiatrist in South Africa, and he and I decided about 10 years ago that a DSM that was based on evolutionary biology and behavioral ecology would make more sense and be better. And we put ourselves to that task, and we thought very hard about how would you change diagnosis to make it more sensible with a proper scientific foundation. And at the end of our year of work, we wrote an article that's been widely cited about why diagnosis of mental disorders is so difficult. And we concluded that the DSM is really pretty good for giving us clusters of things that all go together. It makes a fundamental mistake of not distinguishing symptoms from diseases. It's very much if the rest of medicine had cough disorder and fever disorder instead of looking for the things that arouse these protective responses. But other than that, the DSM is pretty darn good at describing the clusters of what we see. The objections to the DSM and the traditional psychiatric diagnosis have come mostly from neuroscientists who really are very frustrated because those diagnoses don't correspond to specific genes or specific brain abnormalities. So they assume there must be something wrong with the diagnosis. But there's another alternative, and that is that we have been thinking too simply about these things, and the assumption that we're going to find specific genes, specific brain loci, is not correct.
Yeah, and I think if you emphasize the evolutionary reasons, if I will, for symptoms, then you would be less confused by the fact that diagnoses frequently overlap. They're not discrete. Anxiety and depression bleed into each other, and not just that. And even bipolar and schizophrenia can co-occur in the same person. And does that mean that they have two disorders, or does it just mean that they have a more complex picture? They're not discrete disorders to begin with, so it's very confusing.
It's like someone who has heart disease and they have both chest pain and swollen ankles. Are these two different disorders, or are they two different manifestations of one? It's often hard to tell.
So you, in your book, you talk about depression rates as tending to be stable across decades in a given culture, but vary widely by country. And you cite some examples here, which are really quite astounding, that the lifetime rates of depression range from 1.5% in Taiwan to 19% in Beirut, ranging from 3% in Japan to 17% in the United States. And it could be argued that there's maybe biological or genetic differences between different populations, but it seems, intuitively anyway, more likely that it has to do with the level of social cohesion and support within a particular culture. That in Japan, I would think you have much, much more of a group-centered culture than an individualistic one. And it just strikes me that there are stresses that are really profound stresses in the United States that, if they were addressed, would have a much bigger bang for the buck than typical psychiatric treatment. Like having a better social safety net, for instance, attending to childhood trauma more readily and more conscientiously, things like that.
So thanks for reminding me of those dramatic statistics. I had forgotten the exact numbers, but they're huge, aren't they? If we could get the depression rates in the United States down to those in Taiwan, that would do more good than all the treatment we're doing. So you'd think there would be big research experiments trying to figure out what's the difference. And I agree with you that social cultural things are likely to be important, but they might be mediated by people's diets, by the prevalence of drugs, by pollution. And there are a lot of physical factors also that are different. I think it's less likely that there are genetic differences between populations. That there's not too much evidence for that. But who knows what the differences are. You're absolutely right, though, that the challenges of living in a capitalist country weigh heavily on all of us, and especially on some individuals. If you could get fired at any moment, even after working at a high-level job for 20 years, my goodness, there's constant anxiety every time you go to bed, wondering. And nobody can really feel secure. In Japan, suicide rates have gone up dramatically ever since the cultural traditions of work have changed. And there was one time when they actually had to shut down a road because so many men were jumping off a particular bridge onto a particular train. And it turned out that many of them were people who had been let go after many years in a particular firm, and there wasn't any alternative for them because the rest of the structure of employment in Japan didn't allow you any way to get back in because all the positions were filled with lifetime employment, basically. So these social cultural things are so profoundly important. I don't think even calling them stress, I think, does an injustice to them, because it's people who get in these social traps or find themselves in these social traps where what are you supposed to do if you get laid off from your job after 20 years and you're a subspecialist in a certain something for that company and those skills don't transfer? What the heck are you supposed to do?
If in Japan, if part of the culture used to be to perform harakiri, there's a specific ritualistic way of doing yourself in because you've lost face. And once you lose face to that extent, you can never regain it. That's a very much of a cultural kind of phenomenon. So you talk about depressive episodes as potentially damaging a person's social network. And you talk about kindling at one point. And kindling is the thought that once you have a depressive episode, or similar to an epileptic episode, it takes a weaker and weaker stimulus or setback to kindle another episode. You also point out that depressive episodes can damage a person's social network, and that if the obstacles to major life goals that cause the depression persist after the symptoms lift, then making more episodes can be likely for that reason, not necessarily for a strictly biological one. I think you present both cases in your book. I'm not sure that you resolved them.
And there's a third one, too. The kindling, for those, most listeners won't know this, but it's an analogy with what happens with epilepsy. People who do research on epilepsy sometimes give epileptic seizures to mice. And the more seizures you give them, either come from brain stimulation or from drugs that cause epileptic seizures, the easier it is for them to have future seizures. So that's the idea of kindling, like little bits of wood in a fireplace starting off a fire. And that has been analogized to depression, as you were just saying, becoming more common after you've had multiple episodes. And there are some brain changes that are related to episodes in the hippocampus and the like. But are those changes actually a product of depression, or are they a cause of depression? It really seems much more of an unanswered question. But people are not fully considering these other alternatives that you just mentioned. One is that the episode damages your social network. But another one is that there might be a built-in mechanism that's continually assessing the nature of your surroundings and how many opportunities there are for you. And if you've tried three other things in the last few years and each big effort has ended in failure, then the whole system kind of adjusts to make it like, hey, this is not that great an environment. Maybe putting in more effort is not going to work. So it makes depression more likely. This is much worse for anxiety, by the way, because the anxiety system clearly adjusts as a function of your experience. And if you go to the watering hole one night and a lion chases you back to camp, the next night you're going to be a little bit careful. And after that, you'll get more and more relaxed. But if three times in a row you go to the watering hole and there's a lion there, it would be very sensible to make the threshold almost nothing and for that system to go off with a hair trigger. And that ends up making ordinary panic attacks into panic disorder, because many people essentially experience fear of fear. They interpret their panic symptoms as a heart attack or a brain problem. And once they start interpreting that, then the least increase in their heart rate makes them think, oh my gosh, maybe I'm going to have a heart attack. And of course, that fear causes more increase in their heart rate in a positive feedback vicious cycle. So all of these systems that are self-adjusting increase the risk. These are a great example of what I was trying to say before about some systems that are intrinsically vulnerable to failure. Any system that intrinsically adjusts to become more sensitive after repeated exposure runs the risk of getting into a vicious cycle.
Yeah, so this brings up the whole topic of trauma, and trauma in some ways seems like an overused concept these days, but maybe it's also underused, that if trauma at the root of it is a kind of a learned experience that life is really dangerous, then I think that it probably has many different forms. We have the diagnosis of PTSD, but I'm wondering if we ought to have a kind of a more of a spectrum approach to it, that when a person has a bad experience in a certain area, and they become spooked in a sense. And then it's easier to be anxious about that particular thing again. And it can be generalized to varying degrees. Some people generalize more readily than other people. Some people might be spooked only about a very specific thing, like if they have a panic attack only in grocery stores, then they'll avoid grocery stores. But other people avoid all stores. You know, it's some variability there.
So the research on PTSD is wonderful. It doesn't give us a really clear, crisp conclusion about some things, but it's very clear that some people are much more vulnerable to a bad experience causing months or years of excess responsiveness, while other people, not so much. What predicts that? A prior history of anxiety or depression makes it more likely. And likewise, other bad things happening in the person's life make it more likely. And there are genetic tendencies that make it more likely. But this doesn't mean that only some people are prone. Anybody who experiences a life-threatening situation, especially watching something terrible happen to a loved one, any normal person is going to have extreme avoidance of anything like that. They're going to get anxious when they see anything that might even give a hint, the smoke detector principle again, of that situation occurring again. And they're going to try very hard to avoid those kinds of situations. Do we think about post-traumatic stress disorder as a normal response to save your life? Or do we think of it as an over-response and the whole system going into some kind of a positive feedback loop that's abnormal? That question is unanswered. Chris Cantor is a good researcher in Australia who's tackled this with a long book and a number of articles, hasn't found a very specific answer to it. And I don't think I know the answer. It certainly seems in all the patients I see with post-traumatic stress disorder, that's a useless, stupid, excessive, abnormal thing. And we try to help people get out of that syndrome. But again, if you start thinking about the fact that it might save your life, you have to realize that these responses are not shaped for our welfare. They're shaped for maximizing benefits to genes and the like. And so we can't expect them to necessarily be very well designed. I do think post-traumatic stress disorder in most cases is a terrible brain abnormality as a result of things that happen to people that happens more to some people. But that's not very satisfying, is it? Wouldn't it be nice to have a specific gene or a specific brain locus or specific something that we could get to and fix it? Oh, that'd be so nice.
It would be nice, but it would make psychiatry so simple that it wouldn't be as interesting.
I'd be glad to have the whole field less interesting if we could be more helpful.
Yeah. So just to close, in your work, you found that explaining to patients about evolutionary principles is helpful to them, that it helps them feel less crazy. It helps them feel understood and in a way that they can see themselves as that their brain is on their side, in a sense.
I think that's probably the single most clinically useful aspect of evolutionary thinking, is simply talking with patients about scientific explanations for why these bad emotions exist. And simply recognizing, no, it's just not that you're a weak person or a bad person or that you have a brain disease. It's that there are good reasons why these responses exist of anxiety and depression. And in many people, there are a lot of false alarms for good reasons. And those simple things help a lot of people to change their view of themselves from a damaged victim to a person who has advantages as well as disadvantages and needs to do whatever is necessary to get things back more towards the minimal kinds of unhappiness that are more common for most people.
Randolph Nesse, I want to thank you so much for coming on to Delving In, the co-founder of the field of evolutionary medicine and the author of the recent book, Good Reasons for Bad Feelings. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Anyone who really wants to know more about the book easily can just go to goodreasons.info. Goodreasons.info gives more information about the book, and lots of free papers and other resources of mine are available there.
Okay, thank you. I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.